Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, so next week will be our Reading with Rogues, which is Long Halloween and Harrow County. Yep. And all things Halloween comics.
Yep, everybody should be reading right now because Long Halloween is long.
It is. It's a long one. That's why it's called Long Halloween, right?
It's right long.
Right there in the title.
Yeah.
But I need to read Harrow County.
Yep, you do. It's good.
I only read the first issue of it a little ways back, and I remember really liking it. I was like, I'll wait for the trade. A few trades out now.
There's three trades out now.
Probably a good time to read it.
I read the first trade sort of on a whim on vacation and really, really liked it. Now I want to read the rest of them.
Was it a harrowing experience?
It was not a harrowing experience, but it was county.
It was a county experience.
Yes, yes. I counted pages.
Let's move on.
Then October 15th, that Saturday, we will have Dead of Winter as our game night. And we'll also have other games like Pandemic Ring of Cthulhu, some other Halloween games. You might sense a theme, which is Halloween.
Yes.
We're big on Halloween here at Rogues. And that goes up to our other event for this month, which is Saturday, October 29th, Halloween Comic Fest. Come in, get yourself some free Halloween comics.
Yep. Yep. We were just getting those counted off today. The newer ones are arriving. In
yep. Little mini comics.
Yep.
All right. We have a lot of news. And it is in no particular order, so I'm just going to run through it, and there'll be no rhyme or reason. We will talk about so many things.
It'll be like movies, video game, the theater, opera.
There's no opera.
Oceanography.
There is no oceanography.
Video games, though?
There are video games.
Why shouldn't there be more oceanography? I like oceanography.
Let's dive in.
There might be no video games. Anyway, Jon Favreau, who successfully helmed a number of things, on Iron Man, of course. More notably, though, for this time, is the Jungle Book adaptation, the live-action Jungle Book that for Disney, which was great.
It was very good.
Nick, did you wind up picking that one up?
I didn't pick it up.
You're budgeting yourself right now. So.
Right, yeah, but I did see that in theaters.
Yeah, me too.
And I loved it.
Dave, you saw it, right?
Yep. I actually ended up through circumstances seeing it twice.
Wow.
And I liked it both times, so.
The second time, you weren't like, too many monkeys.
I have not
is the best part of that, though.
Purchased it yet, but I'm likely to pick it up.
I'm leaning in that direction, too. I really liked it. Jon Favreau, who directed that, is doing a live-action Lion King for Disney, which almost anyone else doing, or really them doing, is like, most of the reaction I saw online were like, why are they doing this? And that's kind of my reaction, too, is like, I don't know if we need a live-action Lion King. The animated Lion King is really, really good.
I'm surprised that people are surprised, because clearly they were starting to do this. They've been adapting a lot of fairy tales.
The Jungle Book,
which we were just talking about how much we liked, it was a success. Everybody's going to be all over Beauty and the Beast with Emma Watson and whoever plays the Beast.
Wait, Emma Watson isn't the Beast?
She is. Oh, that's right. That's right.
She's playing the Beauty and the Beast. Both
or
roles.
That or Mrs. Potts. I'm not 100%
and Miss,
sure.
But she plays all the roles. It's a one-woman show.
I was going to say, I mean,
her guest on is going to be amazing.
Is very smart about all their adaptations, live-action adaptations so far.
They usually look to bring whatever it is. They try and bring a little something new to it. It seems like Jungle Book was pretty significantly different from the animated one, even
agreed.
If it used the same principles.
Yeah,
and they're getting good people behind it. Jon Favreau did a bunch of them, and then Cinderella was Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, I've not seen that. That one sort of went completely under my radar.
I enjoyed it.
This one was kind of, I guess Maleficent wasn't really that was essentially their Wicked. Which is
but it was them bringing their animated universe into the live action universe.
Right, they used
solid.
The visual style of
and it's good.
So
I like
been,
it.
They've been doing that stuff for a bit. I'm
on board. I'm 100% on board. Live action Lion King. I love the animated movie, and I like what Jon Favreau does. I've realized that Jon Favreau is one of my favorite directors. Just looking at what he does, it's you know everything from Jungle Book to Chef to
Elf.
He does so many great movies. So I'm excited for this. I don't know what the twist is going to be. I don't know if they'll get to play it, but I'm excited.
Do you think it's going
to
be like CG sort of in the style of Jungle Book?
I would expect yes.
Because that was a good look.
Yeah,
it
worked great.
Did a really good job. It makes him the obvious person for it because he's been through all the tech stuff now. And Jungle Book managed to do something that, like, say, all the Star Wars prequels failed at, which is do, like, incredible amounts of green screening but still keep it lively and, warm in particular.
Here's the question. They're calling it a live-action adaptation. Can you still call it live-action if it's entirely CGI? Because there are no human characters in Lion King.
What if they put one in there?
Who would they put in?
I don't know.
Johnny the Lion King's buddy, the human,
Mowgli
human buddy,
is in it now.
Mowgli's in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
The
Disney Cinematic Universe.
Or maybe they are going to use real locations but CG beasts.
Honestly, I think that might be the twist.
Yes. But is that live action? Do we call it live action?
It's in the real world.
Okay.
Lion King is one of my least favorite Disney movies.
Really?
Never a big fan.
You're one of my least favorite people.
How did you not like Jeremy Irons' Scar?
I like Jeremy Irons, all right.
I'm familiar with his work.
Didn't Whoopi Goldberg play one of the...
Hyenas? You're not helping,
You're not making your case here. That's like not helping. Rosie O'Donnell played one of the characters in Tarzan. I like Tarzan better than Lion King.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I think for some reason the music didn't particularly reach me in that. And in Lion King...
I love the music on Lion King. I had that CD.
It's Elton John. It's awesome.
Was it Elton John?
He did some of the stuff, but he it was one of the regular guys who did like I Just Can't Wait to Be King and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was like Alan Menken or one of the regular dudes.
Yeah. Elton John did all the music on something else, right? Like all the music on something.
Well, Tarzan.
No, that was Phil Collins.
Oh man, I mixed up my white voice.
It's easy to do.
Those are some seriously white rockers.
Yeah.
I mean, not to say that Tarzan is a bad movie, I actually have a lot of fondness for that movie.
Tarzan's a great movie.
But for some reason it didn't quite click with me. You know what, weirdly, I felt almost that Jeremy Irons, while a bad guy, I feel like there was something when I saw it that I felt like some sympathy for him, or felt like just because he was like the weak and scrawny one that he kind of got like shoved off to the side and like he had a somewhat legit claim, even though, yes, he had become an evil person.
Yeah, so you're saying you root for the bad guys in all the Disney movies?
Yes.
You're like...
Just the nerdy bad guys.
Go Ursula against the Little Mermaid.
You know, wasn't wild about Timon and Pumbaa?
It's a little over the top. I'll grant you that.
But the whole reason I bring that up is to say that I actually might end up liking the live action over the original.
Yeah, it doesn't have as high a bar clear for
we'll
clear
see.
For you.
We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. What We Do in the Shadows, movie we all liked.
Yes.
Is getting a TV show from... Taika Waititi? I'm going to have to learn to pronounce this guy's name. Yeah, he's directing Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
And Jemaine Clement.
Yep.
It is going to be aired on New Zealand TV.
Uh-huh.
So everybody should get their New Zealand antennas ready. But most likely it'll wind up on Netflix before long.
I was going to say.
So
are they still doing a film sequel?
They're still doing the film sequel, Werewolves.
Werewolves.
Yep.
But this is going to be, What We Do in the Shadows is going to be sort of a TV spinoff. That actually, there's totally room for that to be sort of a meandering TV series, because it's not like a plot-heavy film.
No.
Right. I assume it'll be the Flight of the Conchords of vampire TV shows, of New Zealand-centric vampire TV.
New Zealand vampire sitcom.
Yeah.
It'll be amazing.
I think there's people out there who still haven't seen What We Do in Shadows, and you definitely need to amend that if you have not.
It's great.
I don't know if it's streaming anywhere.
It was on HBO. I don't know where. I don't think it's streaming right at the moment.
It is a weird, dry New Zealander sense of humor, but it's really good. I would say I'm looking forward to that.
Planet of the Apes, Green Lantern crossover, February 2017.
Talk about comics, not movies here.
Yes,
unless they're bringing back Ryan Reynolds.
So this is DC and Boom.
DC and Boom.
Who they had previously done the...
have they worked together before?
Star Trek.
No, that
was DC IW.
I was IDW.
Oh, right.
Green Lantern is just a whore. He crosses over with everyone.
But Star Trek has been to Planet of the Apes, because they did do a crossover with them.
That's true.
So in that sort of 6 degrees of separation, they are all connected.
Yeah. Now, does this mean we're going to get it sort of an Aliens, Predator, Mindhunter, where like there's 8 licenses together at some point, where it's like Green Lantern, Planet of the Apes, Star Trek, Star Wars,
Mask
Transformers, Rom, Predator versus Aliens?
Yes.
Care Bears.
That's it. Actually, Green Lantern and Care Bears makes a lot of sense.
Actually, I feel like Deadpool and My Little Pony is a ticket to
print
money.
I agree.
License to print money. Now this so
Deadpool, Harley Quinn, My Little Pony.
I feel like the Star Trek. What was it?
Green Lantern, Planet of the Apes.
Green Lantern, Planet of the Apes. They've only announced it, right?
Yeah, we don't know anything.
Teams, we don't know premise or anything there. So here's what seems a little weird to me: Green Lantern and Star Trek universe. You know, because they've
both spacefaring.
Well, also there's a power equilibrium there, like a whole starship. Okay, that's like up there with Green Lantern.
Yep.
The Planet of the Apes is like kind of street level, for lack of a better term. It is it's guerrilla warfare. If there's going to be fighting, it is not high tech.
What if Caesar gets his hand on like a Sinestro ring?
Actually, I imagine something like that probably is likely. Yeah. That's probably the case.
Well, Star Trek crew's got all the lantern rings, and
those rings are a dime a dozen. We sold them for $1 a piece for a long time.
Yeah. We got a really good deal on them. Yeah. All.
So. One of these days, that's going to come back and bite us.
Probably so.
When the lantern wars all.
Yeah.
Break
why
out.
Did we sell those black lantern rings? What were we thinking?
Like zombies. I like zombies.
We got to make money.
That's a reasonable point. All right. Voltron Season 2 has a trailer, which is mostly a mood trailer. I don't know if you guys watched it.
I didn't get a chance.
I decided not to. I saw some articles saying like, oh, it suggests big changes in store. And I was like, oh, I kind of don't want to see it until I can get it in context.
It suggests big changes in store if you're looking for big changes. If you're looking for it to be the same show, it suggests that. It is all mood pieces. There's no story spoilers at all.
Okay. That's another one that if people haven't seen it, go watch Voltron.
Oh, yeah.
Legendary Defender, right?
And yeah, Skeleton's crushed it. It's really good. And it's going to be... It's going to be coming back out with season 2 in late 2016, so we don't have to wait very long.
Okay.
Which is cool.
Another, like, 13-episode probably kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. Yeah, that was one of the most pleasant surprises I had last year. And I think my thing when I went to watch it, even though I knew it was the Last Airbender people,
mm-hmm.
I was kind of like...
It's Voltron.
I'm going to watch an episode, it'll probably be well-crafted, but I'll just move on. There was enough in the first episode to intrigue me, and then very quickly I was pretty into it.
Actually, I think you might have been the one who put both of us onto it. I think you were the one who watched it first.
I think that's true.
And we were both like, oh, I guess we should watch this.
Yep.
And then coming a little later is Iron Fist. They gave us a now that Luke Cage has aired,
yeah.
They gave us an air date for Iron Fist, which is March 17th, which is too far away for me.
It's not that far.
It's far enough.
You haven't finished watching Cage yet.
I have not finished watching Luke Cage yet, but we'll talk about Luke Cage a little later.
You just stretch that out between now and March.
Yeah, sure.
You watch 10 minutes a day, every 5 days.
But we have Cage, then in November is Doctor Strange.
Yep.
What's after that? Is Iron Fist.
Okay. Punisher somewhere in there?
Nope.
Okay, he's a ways out.
Punisher just started filming. Punisher's going to be after Defenders and probably after Daredevil Season 3 or Jessica Jones Season 2.
Yeah, sure.
Let's talk about Indiana Jones.
All right.
There is an animation going around. It's a
like a fan.
An amateur. Someone who's done it for like... But we're going for like 5 years.
Right.
And we'll post the link in the YouTube link in our show notes, but...
It's like professional quality.
It's about a minute and a half. It's got that John Williams music. And it is basically... You know, you've seen those animations that the guy made for like Buffy and Doctor Who. This is a different guy. But those animations for like a theoretical... Buffy animated series or a Doctor Who animated series.
Right. They're all really good.
This is like that. This would be the opening credits of an Indiana Jones animated show. And
it's sort of a montage of all these different adventures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why Disney, upon seeing this, isn't like, oh yeah, this we should do this.
For all we know, they are. For all we know, they're like, let's do this.
It's pretty recent that it's... I don't know. I mean, I think it is. Is it possible it just connected recently, but it's actually been out there?
I think it's recent. It's definitely been making the rounds recently. I think it's a recent thing.
Yeah.
But... I think this is it's so good.
Yeah, it reads of sort of like a best of with the moments and kind of beats, mm-hmm. According to like the Williams score and things like that.
Well, I was thinking about it. Reminded me before Crystal Skull made everyone sad of how
I still don't know what you're talking about.
Of how much possibility there was in Indiana Jones. You know that you could have done really awesome comics with him, more cool video games. I mean, you know, the whole Tomb Raider and who's the other guy? Drake.
Yeah.
The Uncharted games were all clearly Indiana Jones knockoffs.
Sure.
They found their own identities. You know, they're both great series, but that they could not have been around but for Indiana Jones.
It's true.
And I do remember, like, back in the original Tomb Raider days, there was, like, a flopped Indiana Jones version of that kind of game. So it's like they never got their best games they had were those like adventure games, you know, the ones with the puzzle solving and stuff like that.
Or that Atari 2600 game.
Hey, I played that game.
That game was terrible.
It was terrible.
There were tsetse flies.
There was tsetse flies, which is fun to say. And that was a weird game with all – like every screen you went to was something – some weird new puzzle to solve.
And you use your whip to knock out these little 8-bit things.
Yeah, and you had to swing between mesas.
Oh, man. It was a video game made by someone who clearly never seen Indiana Jones.
Yes, that's about right. Thinking back on it, there's like a lot of sort of missed opportunities, I think, for the character, for franchising him, for new stories. I was reminded of how much I love Indiana Jones watching this little minute and a half little feature.
Yep. And here's the thing. Disney has the rights now. And for all the people like to get on Disney for being the big mega corporation, all that, they are people who know how to take care of their IPs. And I look at what Marvel did with Star Wars, where I was as skeptical as anyone, more skeptical than most. And I was 100% wrong because Marvel put their A-list guys on it and they presented maybe the best Star Wars comics we've seen.
Once upon a time, just as Marvel once had the Star Wars license prior, you know, like 30 years ago and before getting it back, they once had Indiana Jones in there, and they were kind of mediocre comics.
They create a lot of forgettable comics.
I did read them at the time. My brother was buying them, and there were some good moments in there, and they even had, like, Walt Simonson on an issue, and I think John Buscema did some stuff. So there's some good art and some okay storytelling, but it was those movie comics from an era where they tried to, they would take movies, and they'd make them sound like Bronze Age comics.
Yeah.
You know, over exposition, thought balloons, characters that didn't, they sounded more like characters in, a superhero comic than they did Indiana Jones type characters.
Yeah.
And I think they would not make that mistake now. I think there's a better sense of figuring out what a property needs to be.
I feel like that's probably in development right now. And if we talk about it, we're going to look like geniuses in 6 months when it happens.
Any particular artist that you'd like to see?
I was trying to think of this, and I can't think of anybody. I mean, honestly, all the people that have worked on Star Wars. Stuart Eminem would be a great guy for Indiana Jones.
You know, we know he's already doing some other project and he's slow anyway, but Francesco Francavilla.
Yeah, he'd be a good guy.
Way up his alley.
You know who I want to see before Francavilla? And I was going to say Chris Samney.
Chris Samney. Mike Perkins.
See, I would like Francavilla over that. Over him, I think. But by the way,
what about Butch Geist?
Steve Epting.
I was going to say, any of those people who used to work with Brubaker, those kind of strong realists, a lot of the people who were like from the cross-gen days, who are a lot of the Brubaker people, Epting, Geist, those kind of dudes. Who did El Cazador? Was that Epting?
That was Epting.
Yeah.
Also, this is a weird one. Sanford Green, the guy in Power Man and Iron Fist, I'd love to see what he'd do with Indiana Jones.
Well, when you see the animated thing, although this isn't wildly exaggerated, not as much as, say, his cartooning is, but it is a little bit exaggerated, and it reminds you that you can do some fun stuff with, Indiana Jones is not completely out of his element, and with a little bit of exaggerated cartooning.
Oh, man, can you imagine all the Scotty Young variant covers for Indiana Jones?
Oh, man.
Get Phil Hester to get involved.
This needs to happen.
There was a piece of fan art floating around last night that I posted on Facebook, and it seemed like a lot of people enjoyed, that had Captain America, like World War II era Captain America. Yeah. He's even got like a Tommy gun. It's you know, with the triangular shield and stuff, movie style, I guess. And Indiana Jones standing side by side. There's like a knocked out tank behind him.
Yep.
And he's like, Indiana Jones is like going, he's like, Cap. And Captain America's like, Doc.
Yep.
It's like it gives this sense of history.
It's the Mr. Stark Captain moment from Avengers, which remains one of my favorite movie moments in all the cinema of Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think Doctor reads better, for the record. I think it should be Cap, Doctor.
It's possible.
Anyway. Possible. Or even Indy.
Yeah.
But I loved that, and I thought, yeah, that's a good...
But yeah, it's kind of a,
Brian Hurt drew a commission a while back that was a Rocketeer Indiana Jones, and that was a cool-looking thing, too. Yeah, Indy's a guy who you could cross over with stuff. Indiana Jones in the spirit? Sure. Perfect.
Yep.
So, I don't know. At any rate, Indiana Jones needs to make his big return to comics.
It's and time.
A-list comic talent.
It's time to redeem.
So, I don't know if you guys know this. Wonder Woman likes girls.
It's true.
Wonder Woman likes everybody, Randy. What are you talking about?
You're right. Greg Rucka had an interview where he has basically confirmed what I think many people have read in the subtext for a long time, which is Wonder Woman is what in our world will be considered queer. She's interested in women until she meets Steve Trevor, at which point she becomes more interested in men as well.
Right.
And when you're growing up on – and Rucka made the point of if you're growing up on an island of all women, like most people go their entire lives, they've never seen anyone but a woman – Then all your
physical attraction is going to be based in this world.
So that is a normal thing, and of course that's the way it is. And I've seen some of the pushback from people like, oh, why do you have to make a big deal of this? It's such a gimmick from both sides. People thinking it's like a gimmicky thing to do. And I'm like, you know what?
So from sort of progressives that is, they think it's like using it as a novelty.
Yes.
And then on sort of the conservative side, the why can't you just leave sex out of it?
Yeah.
She's a dirty whore if she likes women.
Yes, less of that. But yes. And the thing is, Wonder Woman being queer is a huge statement on the part of DC, although I don't think they're making it. I think this is Rucka making it, and nobody's saying
anything. Well, we talked about it months ago because there was an issue that made it pretty clear.
Yeah.
From Rucka's relaunch, there were like other Amazons talking about their amorous feelings for Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how like, oh, doesn't she, she's already got a girlfriend, or she's got a lot of girlfriends or something.
Yeah.
But they kind of made out that she's been around a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't a new concept. Didn't like Perez
touched on it.
That was a different time, though. He definitely was more oblique about it.
He did it in a sly way, where there was these. He made it clear, though, when there was an ambassadors to Paradise Island.
Uh-huh.
Basically, scholars and intellectuals and stuff got to go and meet with the Themyscirans, and somebody was like, "Hey, what do you Amazons do for sex?" And because they were around in like ancient times, she's like, "Well, some of them are like, have sort of sworn a vow of chastity or like, or, you know, and I don't know if she actually made out that any of them were waiting for men to find the island again. And as the way they put it, she's like, some follow like the path of Sappho. So you can figure that one out. And then this one always cracked me up because of what it snuck in. And she's like, and she's like, many follow the path of Narcissus. So, again, you don't have to be too imaginative to figure out what they're talking about. But it was a clever way to get it in there.
Yeah. I think just Matt Sturgis, who's the writer of Ever After and numerous other things, posted a thing on Facebook that was really, really telling. He posted about the Justice League. And he points out that basically, he's like, all these people are white, heterosexual, cisgendered males. And he's like, why is there not representation for other people? Look at these characters and see themselves in them. And this is a nice step that Wonder Woman... They do have Cyborg now, yes. But in general. The point he was making was white, heterosexual, cisgender males. And yet, when you do anything that's not that, a bunch of people freak out. And it's
right.
Like, maybe it's okay to have the occasional difference.
Right.
And I think that it sends an interesting message to have one of their main female characters be queer because
right.
it gives a lot of young queer women someone to look up to, someone to idolize.
I think that, I sort of, at least on some level, understand some of the criticism in the sense that it's like, she kind of clearly was not bi or queer when she was created. And yet, there was so much underlying sort of kink and sort of queer theory, I guess I'd say, in those early ones, that it by no means seems strange to me.
Well, her creator was in a polyamorous relationship with two women, so
right. You
can't tell me that he didn't have that in his head.
Yes. Yes, I feel like had he been able to,
yeah.
he probably would have gone that route.
Yeah, you're not going against the will of the creator, you're going against the will of the times in which it was created,
right.
and screw those times.
And also, although I don't always feel like you have to do what makes sense as far as, like, you know, this is realistic. But yes, on the island of women, makes some sense.
Yeah. All right. Changing topics completely. The Purge might be getting a TV series.
What's
from
the deal with
director,
that?
Director James DeMonico, who's the creator
right.
of the series, is talking about them. He sort of said... money's getting involved. We're starting to talk about casting, that kind of thing. So it's further along in development.
Okay.
But it's still in development. But it's worth talking about because we all really like the Purge series.
Yeah. I still haven't seen the third one.
Me neither.
None of us have yet. But the first two are actually quite good. Surprisingly well written. And in a way, beyond just the premise that everybody's heard, there's a political bent to it. And there's this kind of an interesting science fiction concept thing where it's like, let's take this idea to its logical conclusion beyond just like some home invasion shock story.
It's a concept that I think will work well as a TV show where you can sort of explore the world, explore what the Purge does to society, which is kind of what the movies are about, and maybe even do flashbacks to the origins of
the
Purge.
But again, you can do a little bit with a larger scope instead of the movies, which are very focused on one idea.
Right.
There's
other stuff
series.
In that. It's clear that there's, that the Purge is the outcome of a... Let's say a Trump-like presidency,
yep.
In which the victims, the foremost victims of the Purge, tend to be lower class people, like the poor and lower classes, who are picked on by like creepy, thrill-seeking upper middle class or upper class types.
Yeah.
And it's like the world had to reach a place where that was an acceptable thing, so there has to be all this other stuff going on elsewhere in the world, too.
Yeah.
You know, the Purge, it doesn't exist in a vacuum.
New Founding Fathers.
New Founding Fathers, yeah. So, yeah, I agree. There's some material for them to work with there.
But, I mean, it's going to be violent.
Yeah.
So, I think, like, an FX something along those lines.
If I were to guess, I would guess stars. It's
you
a little
so?
Yeah, it's a little
little pulpy.
I was going to say FX tends to do stuff that's a little more cerebral. I mean,
what if Netflix did it.
Netflix is also a possibility. I can see them because Netflix doesn't really have a particular brand.
No.
Netflix does everything from Narcos to Real Rob to Lemony Snicket to all the Marvel Cinematics.
So, I mean,
so it could be.
But yeah, there's a little bit of a trashy exploitation element in it too.
Yeah. All right, changing tones completely, we have the new CW Fight Club, which is, there's a little teaser that I'll put in the show notes, but if you want to watch it, you have to go to the CW app, which we talked about last week, went live. I'm very happy with it.
We should just quick say, the concept is one that, a repeat of the concept they did last year. Their superhero TV shows have it's kind of like a 5-minute Fight Club for them.
Yeah. The notion is, it's in continuity, but not in continuity. It's like all the characters being characters, not the actors being actors, but they're sort of, the notion is that they all get together and have these fights for fun to show off their powers.
But like heroes and villains alike are often in the mix.
The first one was very much heroes versus villains.
Yes.
There's a lot of humor and like, oh, just let's have some fun putting these two characters in the same place at the same time.
This one, they're sort of ushering in Supergirl as their newest member.
Right.
And
That's where they start from. They start with having kidnapped her and arguing whether or not they actually could have if she didn't let them. And it's sort of a welcome to the CW. Again, there's some meta aspects to it, but it's not all meta. And they're in character the whole time.
And then
they've got a danger room, which is just fantastic, that Cisco and Felicity are running.
Yep, and it's hilarious watching those two key off of each other.
That's what I love about all of this. It really shows the shared universe that the CW has built. It's almost as good to me as what the Marvel Cinematic does, which is what a good shared universe does, it doesn't strangle you with continuity. It allows you to have these characters interplay with each other. And that's what shared universe should be about. These little 5-minute shorts do better at that than almost anything else DC's done.
I love the bit in it at the beginning where it looks all sinister at first, like Supergirl's tied to this chair or chained to it or whatever. And they're like, you know, talking to her in these menacing tones about what's going on. And she's like, oh my gosh, is this that Fight Club thing?
Yeah.
And she's like really excited about it. And she just breaks the chains, just like, oh, let's do it.
Yeah. And I won't give away the ending, but the ending's hilarious.
Yeah.
So it's really great.
It's kind of the most in-jokey sort of fun thing that they do to promote their superhero shows. And it's a must-watch.
It worked because I was down on Flash Season 2 by the end, and I was down on Arrow enough that I wasn't sure I was going to watch it.
Kind of reinvigorated.
And I was down on Legends of Tomorrow, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to give all of them a shot.
Yeah.
Well, now that they actually have an app that works and it's functional.
Yes.
And it's free.
It's free.
Everyone
can watch these shows for free, and I think that's going to be huge.
Yeah.
All right. There is a shout-out to a fan of ours, Lucas Testro, who is a fan of the Roguecast and Comic Pants before that. So that goes back a ways. For those who don't know, Comic Pants was the site that we started when we were all working together at the store many years ago. It was actually when Criminal Number 1 came out.
10 years plus.
We were doing comic reviews. Dave was doing it for Ain't Cool News. I was doing it for my site, The Fourth Rail. Yeah. And we decided to launch a comic review site altogether. And we did a podcast, which is now lost to the ages.
Yep.
It's kind of too bad.
Some good ones.
Yeah, those are all completely gone. No one has it. We were trying to come up with a name, and I think it was Dave who coined it. He's like, we just call it something ridiculous like Comic Pants. And we did, and that's what it was. And we did that for 3 or 4 years.
For the record, my email address is still based in the Comic Pants email address.
Yes, it's Hefe Pants.
Hefe Pants, yes.
Which every time I give that, and also my backup email is pants.randy@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And every time I give it out to someone like who I don't want to have my regular email, I wonder if they're thinking, like, what kind of fetish bullshit is this?
Well, mine is even worse because I still use mine as well as a secondary email.
That's
Punisher Pants.
Punisher Pants, that's right. Yep.
So the pants live on is what we're saying.
Yes, they do.
They do.
At any rate, Lucas messaged us saying that he's a fan. He's from Melbourne, Australia. And he has done some short films, including a time travel one that you can find free on YouTube, and I'll post a link to that. But his new short film, Capes, which is a 8-minute short, It's sort of a spoof on the trope of the expendable sidekick.
Uh-huh.
Is in the Fantastic Fest or the Austin Film Festival that is going to be going on Friday, October 14th. There's going to be a series of shorts, and his is one of them. I have passes that he's given me to give out. So,
oh, that's cool.
If anyone would like to go, I've got 4 passes. And if anyone is interested in going, drop us an email at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. You can claim one or two of them if you would like. If you're greedy, you can claim all 4, or we might be able to offer that up. If you want to go catch this film and a bunch of other shorts, Lucas says he's going to stop by the store when he comes to Australia. I'm looking forward to meeting him. And I watch Capes. It's really, really funny.
Nice.
And I recommend watching his other time travel ones. So definitely worth a look. And whenever Capes goes up online, we'll definitely post a link to that too.
Yeah, well done.
We have the bad guys from Legends of Tomorrow.
Bad guys from Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah, the Dominators.
Oh, right. I was like, well, what are you even talking about?
You have them in your pocket.
We know who, sort of like, the big bad of the season.
The big bad of the season, or at least this, we think it's the season.
Is it Legends of Tomorrow, or I guess I thought this was going to be their crossover bad guys.
It is their crossover, you're right.
Okay.
It's the Dominators.
Yeah, yeah. Which is not, some people are probably like, who are the Dominators?
They're those aliens with the big forehead discs.
They're big yellow-headed, big ol' alien.
They weren't introduced, but they were definitely given prominence in the invasion story that Giffen did.
They were introduced.
Were they introduced in that?
Yeah, that was there was an intent, I think, in that to solidify some more sci-fi races for DC.
Yeah.
And what's weird is, it was a good idea, to be honest, even if Invasion is a lacking miniseries. And I'm always surprised that they don't run with it some more. The Dominators are good, creepy, bad guys.
They are.
They're sort of...
they look like Mars Attacks Martians to some extent. Yeah, they're big heads and sharp teeth.
I think they sort of tend to wear robes and have a slightly cult-like demeanor.
Yeah.
But they're definitely always been high-tech. The Legion has dealt with them heavily, like especially the 5 years later
They
run.
Became big Legion villains.
Yeah, they like took over and stuff.
And that's what I wonder.
Yeah.
Does this mean we're going to start seeing the Legion in live-action TV? Because time.
Hell, if you're getting into this kind of sci-fi stuff, if ever you were going to break out Green Lantern stuff, too, that's an opportunity.
So, I'm excited by this. I'm curious to see what the crossover looks like.
Yeah, I would love to see some cool sci-fi stuff break in there. You know, the crew from Legends of Tomorrow having to deal with, like, an alien, you know, like, Dominator spaceships
Does that
and
mean
stuff like that.
Superman's going to be involved in this crossover?
Wouldn't surprise me. They've got him.
Yeah.
I mean, I expect them to be... At some point, they're going to have to form the Justice League of this universe, right? They've got Superman, they've got Supergirl, they got Flash, they got Green Arrow, they've got all these other people. They're forming the Justice Society.
Yeah.
I would almost, even though this kind of goes against historicity, I would have Superman off have... You know, he's like, oh, he's off dealing with stuff in the Phantom Zone or whatever. Go and make Supergirl the founding member.
I like it. Yeah.
She's the one with the show.
The other question is...
She's earned it.
You don't have a Batman, which is a little weird. Do you have to do Batman?
Arrow's basically Batman.
He's basically Batman.
I want Batman to show up and be like, you're not me.
You don't have a Wonder Woman. You don't have a Wonder Woman.
Why don't they do a Wonder Woman show?
Because they want to save her for the movies.
Yeah, and I guess Batman keeps getting saved for that, too.
Yeah. But it would be kind of cool to have a Wonder Woman. But yeah, you just do, you know, Hawk Girl, Martian Manhunter... Supergirl, they've got a lot of the guys are in there.
It's true.
No Aquaman either. Aquaman's also being safe in the movies. DC is so dumb about this. Like the Suicide Squad was launched in Arrow as a way to test the viability of the Suicide Squad so they could do the movie. And then once the movie was happening,
they
took them away from the show. And I'm like, there is nothing wrong with having more than one version.
No. Yep.
You're going to have more than one
they've
Flash.
They've been rather explicit about multiverses and stuff in all of these things.
Yeah.
All of their toys and things lately are like DC Multiverse line.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like even non-fans, I think, will get the idea, okay?
Yeah. You can have more than one Flash. They're going to have more than one Flash. You can have more than one Green Arrow. You can have more than one of these. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Dominators are cool villains.
Yes. One last CW thing. That is the Vixen animated series.
Yep.
Is getting a 6-episode second season, which starts on October 13th on CW Seed, which is also online for free, and there's an app if you have an Apple TV or some of those other things. I've watched it. It's fun. Uh-huh. And Vixen is going to make her live-action debut on Legends of Tomorrow this year.
I never got around to seeing any of those.
It's fun.
Is anybody going to be notable playing her?
I don't remember the actress's name, but she's good.
They tend to go with unknown-ish
people. She's good, and she's playing her in live-action as well.
Okay.
Did we ever talk about seeing, like, the full JSA, like, in costume, the picture?
No, we've seen the picture, but that's all we've seen.
I thought they looked good.
It's pretty good, yeah. They've got, Doc Midnight, Stargirl.
What's this for?
Legends of Tomorrow.
I thought Stargirl in particular, I mean, looked very close to her comic.
Stargirl looks good. She looks a little older.
Yeah.
But I think that's fine. Yeah, it's interesting looking. All right. Let's talk about Batman. Because Ben Affleck has revealed the title of his movie, which I think everyone is pinning their hopes to Ben Affleck in the same way they pinned their hopes to like Nolan being involved. But that's all other things aside. Affleck is definitely getting on board with this. No, it's going to be my Batman. It's going to be what you guys want. And the movie is called The Batman.
Yeah, it's you know what's interesting about that is, well, I mean, this is their first solo Batman movie in the
cinematic universe.
DC cinematic universe, yes. Separate from the Nolan stuff.
Yes, because he's been in both. He's been in Batman v Superman. He's been in Suicide Squad.
Yeah. But yeah, with a title of The Batman, while not wildly creative, I get it as far as, like, it sounds like a rebuilding story.
Yes. Well, also, it's going to have Deathstroke. It's not going to be origin stuff.
Yep.
If we never see Batman's parents murdered again, I'll be perfectly happy.
What if he brands people again?
Oh, God.
I don't think he will. I think we're going to see the turn.
No more branding.
No more branding.
Aquaman should just tell him that.
Hashtag no more branding.
Feel the brand.
And a couple last small stories. Pirates, the Pirates of the Caribbean, which we talked about last week with that comic.
Oh, right.
It sort of restored our interest in the series.
And as a fun cue.
Just in time, as if Disney knows what it's doing, Dead Men Tell No Tales gets a trailer. Little sort of a mood trailer by anything else.
It was like a minute and a half or more, but it was still just kind of like, it was the teaseriest of...
Well, and it's also introducing their new villain, and that's Javier Bardem, and he's always...
He's fantastic. Undead, he's leading some undead crew of pirates, and they threaten some new pretty boy.
These guys look more like zombie undead than, like, say, Barbossa's skeletal pirates.
Well, they remind me a little
I want him to run. I want him to run head to head and have a fight between zombie pirates and skeleton.
We all want that, Dave. It reminds me a little bit of the Davy Jones weird underground, weird underwater fish looking people.
Right.
Got that sort of sunk waterlogged zombie looking thing.
Yeah, and he had a thing going on where his hair moved the way your hair moves underwater.
Yeah,
like he was like kind of looked normal and like zombie-ish looking, but his hair had that weird thing going on.
And he comes and
those
talks
guys
to
their special effects.
He comes and talks to the new Orlando Bloom stand-in, which is some other pretty boy we don't know.
Yeah,
and that guy apparently knows how to find Captain Jack.
Who makes no appearance in the trailer.
Yeah.
They seem to be holding out for the big reveal, probably in the first serious trailer.
Yep.
But it looked fun. Like I liked the vibe. There was kind of an air of menace. There was a little bit of humor as Javier Bardem does.
Yeah,
does kind of. He's very villainous, but there's a little camping it up.
Yeah.
I think you have to camp it up in Pirates.
Absolutely. I would be disappointed if they went too serious.
But it's a little spooky, which reminds me of what I liked about the first one. They definitely made the bad guys kind of spooky.
And I think at this point, broadly speaking, I think people are pretty worn out on the series.
Yeah.
So I do think they're going to kind of have to prove themselves a little bit.
Agreed.
Which makes me a little bit wary of a guy who's of another pretty boy hero.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I feel like you could do a kind of cool swashbuckling hero who almost like threatens to take to steal the scenes from Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
And see what happens. Like, what happened if they had like somebody like the equivalent of Mal from Firefly going up against him? It may be too... rogue alpha male fighting to pull off, but we'll see.
They should have brought that female pirate captain back from the first movie. She was great.
Yeah.
I would like to see her. But yeah. All right. Two tiny stories. Well, one potentially big, but Michael Rowe, I don't know who this is, by the way, some actor, is playing Ninjak in the Valiant web series, and we saw the first picture, and it looks great.
Yeah. It's just a costume thing, right?
Yeah. And then we saw Jason David Frank,
who played the Green Ranger.
Played the Green Ranger in Power Rangers, dressed as Bloodshot, and it was so good, I thought it was a piece of concept art.
Yeah. But no, it's him.
It's him. So they're not getting exactly called like A-list talent, but these look interesting.
Well, and also we were talking about, I guess, was it Chris? Told us that...
The guys who do Superpower Beatdown, which
Handling a lot of the...
Bat in the Sun Productions, I think is what they're called.
Yes, it is.
That they're handling a lot of it, which means they're going to be some good action.
Yeah.
It means it might be a little cheesy, but it'll be entertaining to watch.
Now, they're still proceeding forward with full-blown movies.
Apparently, Harbinger is to be the first Valiant Universe movie. I can totally see a Valiant Cinematic Universe working. And how embarrassing will that be for DC if Valiant has a successful cinematic universe and they don't?
There might be some snickering.
I'm just saying.
Weirdly, they've found a, I think, like, semi-stable limping along sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where their movies make money, but it's just like they're never really... Fans never fully embrace them, and critics definitely have not been embracing them. And so it seems like nobody's really happy. They're still making money, so I guess they're sort of happy about that.
You know what they are? They're in the Vegas lounge act stage of their lives.
It's kind
of
true.
And that's where you go at the end of your career, not the beginning.
By the way, these are like high-priced lounge acts.
Sure, yeah. Celine Dion has her own theater.
Yeah. They have production values and stuff like that, but you're kind of like,
But it's just kind of sad. Like if the only place you could see Superman was to go to Vegas, go to his own, like, he has his own casino, he has his own place, he's got his own
Fortress of Solitude casino.
His own Fortress of Solitude. He's got his dressing room. He's, you know, he's living a life.
It would be called the Daily Planet. What are you talking about?
But he still lives in Vegas all the time, and that's all he does. He just comes out and lifts heavy stuff for the rubes who are there to drink.
It's a little like that.
I'm just saying. That's what I believe the DC Universe. Stay tuned next week for Randy's next Why DC is Terrible at What They Do metaphor.
He is a big baby about it. I will never miss a chance. That said, I am still, until the Valiant gets anything off the ground cinematically,
oh, sure,
I'm a little skeptical of how that's going to come together.
I'm skeptical as well, except that Valiant on their comics, even though they're very much struggling in sales, even as we are trying to sort of push them a little bit and get people to see that they're really good.
That's a lot of talent, though.
They're doing really good stuff. Like, they're creatively, they're right where they need to be. It's just that getting over that hill when you're basically a new property is tough.
Yeah.
And speaking of new properties having it rough, this is a new property that goes back about 25 years, but DC's giving Wildstorm another shot. Because right. The eighth time is the charm.
Wildstorm, which you may or may not know from titles such as Wildcats, Stormwatch, later on The Authority.
Yeah. It all got folded into
Gen
the DC.
13.
It all got folded into the DC Universe. In fact, there's a Midnight or Apollo title that's very weak that is in the DC Universe. But they're going to do a separate non-DC Universe Wildstorm again. And it's going to be helmed by Warren Ellis.
He's going to be writing the main book.
He's going to be the sort of showrunner in the same way that Gerard Way is doing The Young Animal. And the list of talent so far on this is not as impressive. We don't know who the artists are yet. But the Wild Storm book is the main book he's writing. And then there's also going to be a Michael Cray, which is Deathblow.
Right.
Wildcats and Zealot are all going to get their books.
Zealot, who is from Wildcats.
Yes, from Wildcats.
And was Deathblow also in Wildcats, or is he just like one of those covert ops?
He's part of Team 7, which is in the DNA of Wildcats.
Right.
But no Authority, which is interesting, probably because the Authority got folded in DC, where it never felt like it really belonged.
What's interesting is, you know, so the Wildstorm universe has always been this kind of more covert, espionage-ish, military-ish kind of spin on superheroes. I mean, they had some traditional superheroes in the mix, too, but it's always been a little bit more militarized.
That is its vibe, and that's there's a lot of stuff from Wildstorm that I love. The Warren Ellis' Stormwatch run, Warren Ellis' Authority, which is why this news excites me, because Warren Ellis is the guy who knows how to write Wildstorm. But also Brubaker's Sleeper, which drew off of the Ellis stuff, and Alan Moore and James Robinson's Wildcat stuff, and Joe Casey's Wildcat stuff, where they did sort of a corporate take on superheroes. There is and not a corporate in the way that like Marvel and DC are corporate superheroes, but they were actually a corporation. I can see a version of this that I'm going to love, and I hope that Ellis can bring it.
What I'm not quite sure is what they can bring to the table that they haven't before. You know, there's a part of Wildstorm that's very 90s.
Yeah.
And then they've tried various mergers with the DC Universe to some varying degrees of success, but mostly kind of pretty middle-of-the-road efforts.
I think to make it work...
And it's definitely not going to be part... I mean, although Apollo and Midnighter are in the present-day DC Universe...
I believe the Authority has been excised from the Wildstorm Universe, it looks like.
That's so weird.
It is a little weird. We don't know. This is all sort of early development stuff, but I think if they're going to make it work, it needs to be Ellis's brand of sort of cynicism and wit and sort of technological interest in sort of the sociology of technology.
Yep.
But it also really, if they're going to make it work, I think it needs to incorporate some of the things that David Walker's been doing over at Marvel and Nick Spencer's been doing over at Marvel, which is to incorporate some millennial concepts into it, incorporate Black Lives Matter and the 1% and some of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
WikiLeaks stuff.
Yes,
all of
that kind of thing. I think that a lot of the stuff that is
it
in this sort of...
It needs to feel today.
It needs to feel modern. It needs to feel connected to the world.
You know what I think it needs,
what's,
Randy?
What's that?
Nanotech.
Yeah. Well, it'll probably have that. All right. That's all our huge news info dump for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about the huge week of comics. We are talking comics for Wednesday, October 5th, and guys, it's another big week.
It is. They're crushing us with these comics.
I didn't get to read everything. I had like 20 different number ones to read.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, I think this week sort of beats all things with number ones.
So I know that Nick in particular has a bunch of alt picks in his list.
I could have.
But as always, we're going to stick to two. And I'm going to start with the book that I've been anticipating since it was announced.
And that Marvel is pushing pretty hard this week.
Marvel's pushing really hard, which is Champions number one. This is like a double-sized first issue, I believe. And it is Mark Waid and Humberto Ramos, and it is sort of a spinoff from post-Civil War Avengers, which is interesting,
of
course.
Can we say that this post-Civil War has not ended?
Right, because Civil War still has three issues to go, because Civil War is late. But clearly this is the post-Civil War status quo. I will say there's no spoilers in this for Civil War.
No.
There's definitely not. You get a sense that things are tense, but there's no spoilers in here. But this is – Champions is Ms. Marvel, Nova, and Miles Morales from all different Avengers basically deciding they need to go off on their own and form their own super team because the grown-ups just – they don't
know
what to do.
They keep effing stuff up?
They keep – yeah. They got into a big fight with each other in Civil War. They don't seem to care about the property damage. And for lack of a better term, this is the Millennial Avengers. This is
– Now, I like this idea, but is it making the old Avengers look like crap? Because they, they are supposed to generally care about like property damage.
I don't think they look like crap, but I think they're in a way like
They're too caught up in the big picture, like, oh, we have to resolve this stuff with the Inhuman and all that, and property damage has to be a secondary concern whatever.
The opening features, the two of them, Nova and Miles Morales, during Civil War, clearly, left the Avengers. They got fed up with watching the adults fight, and they left. And Ms. Marvel, because Ms. Marvel's such the huge fangirl, stayed with them. And it opens with the Avengers versus the Wrecking Crew. They're stopping a wrecking on the subway, and the subway train gets wrecked. And Ms. Marvel's saying, hey, well, let's start and fix the train tracks. And Falcon says, look, Stark's not here. We're not engineers. We don't have the building supplies. There are unions. And Ms. Marvel's saying, look, we damaged people's livelihoods. There's a food truck that got crushed. Why don't we stay and stick around with it? And Sam's like, hey, that's not fair. And she's just having none of it. And the adults, they aren't like, oh, screw these people in their food truck. It's just that they're like, there's bigger issues to deal with. And so basically, Ms. Marvel decides that she needs to sort of be the change she wants to see in the world and put together this group. She calls her two buddies. She's like, look, we know we can do the right thing. We just need to go out and do it a different way. And so they recruit the Hulk in a really good scene.
That's totally awesome Hulk, by the way, right?
Yes, it is. And they recruit Viv from the Vision book, who the way they
like
introduce...
Like the daughter of the Vision, right?
Yeah, and I don't know who this character is. I haven't read the Vision books, and I know I haven't read the Vision books. But the reason they introduce her and the reason they bring her in is really clever and really good. And then they have a little throwdown. So it's like, you get everything. You get the walk away, you get the new team forming, and then Ms. Marvel gives her Bill Pullman Independence Day speech over smartphones at the end that is a very moving speech that sort of also has some images hinting at some of the other new young heroes that might join her. And it winds up sort of trending on Facebook and Twitter and that kind of thing. So, like I say, it's Avengers for Millennials, but not in that, ugh, Millennials way. Right. It's this is like...
Well, in a way, it sounds like classic Marvel tropes. Like, well, it sounds like the idealism that I grew up with in the Bronze Age.
Yes,
but that maybe has felt a little bit tarnished with the sort of as the audience has adultified, and they've gotten really obsessed with like superhero versus comics. So every year it's Civil War, X-Men versus Avengers, Secret War, all these hero fight comics.
Right,
and there needs to they need to kind of remember a little bit of the idealism that kind of tends to underlie superheroes.
I think what I like here is the symbolic. What it means to me is that in the Marvel Universe, Captain America is the man. He's the one who's the icon who forms everything. He's the basically he's not the founder of the Avengers, but he might as well be.
Yeah.
Same way here, Ms. Marvel is the central character, and I think it's interesting that in this sort of new Marvel Universe, the central person, the light, the inspiration is a young Muslim teen for Jersey City. I think that says a lot about where Marvel's head is at right now. If you hate that kind of thing, you may hate this book, but you're probably not listening to my recommendations anyway.
But these are all great characters.
Yes,
and Mark Waid gives them a great sense of being.
It's also funny because Waid does funny well.
It's a superhero book, right?
I've never known the character of Viv. I didn't much... I mean,
you had no excitement for it.
No excitement for it. But in one scene, Mark Waid gives me everything I need to know and makes her very likable.
Yeah.
I am very impressed with that.
The other thing that Waid's done in all new Avengers that he does here is they use their powers well together. They have teamwork. Yep. The way they use their powers to rescue some people inside a crate later in the in the episode is really, really clever. It's really good. I think that anyone who likes good superhero team comics is going to read this. It's most likely to wind up on one of my best of lists this year.
Is Ramos sticking around?
Ramos is going to be around for a while. I don't know how long. And his art, by the way,
he's perfect.
I'm not always a Ramos fan, but his work here, especially with colorist Edgar Delgado and Victor Olazaba on art on inks, it looks fantastic.
I have a feeling his art's going to draw a lot of people to it.
Yeah,
I especially like the way he draws Totally Awesome Hulk.
Yeah, me too.
Feels really
he feels different than the regular Hulk.
He does.
He's got a little more of a wiry, big
curiosity
guy feel.
I know why on a commercial level why they might have called it Champions. You just always, you know, you tend to stick with names that have some history for them behind them. Is there any particular reason why they're called the Champions?
No.
In the story?
No, I think it is the name they choose. But I mean, think
obviously,
she just says in her speech, she's like, "Help us become champions."
Okay,
and I think basically people take over that, and it's like not that she named him. She didn't name him the champions.
But somebody keyed off of it.
Somebody keyed off of it.
Probably on a blog or
in
something.
The same way that Lois named Superman or that kind of thing.
Right, makes sense.
Anyway, really great book. I've been excited for it, and I've also been a little nervous because you never know if these are going to live up. But it definitely lives up to the hype. Dave?
I'm jumping over to DC. A book that I had remember talking about when we were doing our previews, reviews.
Yeah.
But not knowing quite what to expect. And it's a weird book, but I ended up liking it a lot. And that is the it's a miniseries, right, Randy?
Yep.
Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love.
Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love.
Which sounds very
cue the Barry White.
Either dirty or gothic romancy, and it's in fact the gothic romancy.
Yes,
thing.
It is not about Barry White.
Anybody who knows Dead Man from DC knows him as a kind of a. Sort of generally a B-lister character. Mm-hmm. Now you got to kind of know a little bit about DC if you're going to know who Dead Man is. But he's, you know, this ghost who can inhabit other people's bodies. He was killed. He's kind of got an old school origin because he was in the circus.
He was
like
a former
everybody
acrobat. There's a lot of circuses in the
60s. And a lot of murders at circuses.
Apparently, so there's just a rampant murders at circuses.
And I guess he sleuthed out his killers and took them down.
Yep.
And is generally kind of just travels around taking over people and helping people out.
He also worked for God, as I recall. Was a woman named Ramakrishna.
Yeah, but it was like God in like a very Eastern sense.
But it was God, it was supposed to be like the.
Is that what it was supposed to be?
I thought so.
But it was weird. Yeah, I don't know. In this one, he is a secondary character, though increasingly important as the story goes on.
Yes,
but in a lot of ways, this is like a classic gothic story. If you've seen anything, even as recent as
the Crimson movie that what's his name
Crimson
did
Crimson Peak. Yes, you know that there's going to be a scary old house and rain swept roads on the way to it, and that kind of thing. And there will be romance and stuff
and longing.
But
don't forget longing.
But not not romance in kind of the cheesy bodice ripper novel,
no.
Sort of sense. So when it begins, our lead character, whose name is going to immediately flee my head.
I don't remember the name. Oh, it's Bernice? Bernice.
Bernice, yes. She is traveling to an old mansion.
Spooky old mansion with a name. And she says at the beginning, she's like, "I would never have lived somewhere with a name, but I fell in love with someone who inherited an old mansion."
Right. She does not like the kind of history in places with like this deep sense of history and therefore like kind of a tragic underpinning to it. And this person she's in a relationship with is trans.
No, that's her friend.
That's
her friend.
Friend
is trans.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Although there's something.
There's definitely some relationship there, but she's in a relationship with a man named Nathan, who's an author who inherited this mansion and who is having sort of headaches. And seems like it might be tied into the evil ghost that's in this mansion.
Right. Speaking of ghosts, she can see ghosts.
Yes. She doesn't like it.
She doesn't like it, but she's kind of learned to live with it. It's almost like somebody learning to live with a kind of a annoying chronic condition, but something you can survive.
Well, it's presented as sort of mental illness. It's like learning to live with depression or one of those things. It's just that while other people think she's crazy, that she's hearing voices, that she's not. She actually is hearing voices.
Right. And she knows, like, when she sees something that usually it calms down after a little while, yeah. and she can do okay with it. But things that seem particularly intense in this house, mm-hmm. There's weird stuff going on, there's creepy stuff, this creepy shadowy cloud that can be seen gliding around, and of course, there's Dead Man.
Boston Brand, who can possess her,
yep.
and because of circumstances we don't know about, he's somehow magically locked in this house.
Right. There's definitely, yeah, there's all sorts of mysteries to be resolved yep. here.
Just, by the way, we haven't talked about the creative team on this book.
Okay, sure. Yeah, creative team, this is one of the reasons I was interested, although I kept forgetting
yeah.
that she was involved. Sarah Vaughan is the writer, not yep. a name that necessarily always, I'm like, oh, Sarah Vaughan.
Yeah.
But she is.
She's the co-writer of Alex and Ada, which is one of the best romance comics that we've read in a long time, yep. and also a great story from Image that has yes, the...
that sci-fi one about sort of a... realistic android type of thing
yeah.
that goes from being also not just a romance thing, but also to having exploring all these interesting sci-fi ideas.
Yes, and has some nice suspense, which I expect this will too.
And in that, as long as we're talking about creators, I also want to mention Lan Medina, who does this painted art that's really exquisite. You know, it's what you want if you're going to have a gothic story. Yeah. Somebody who can draw these amazingly detailed gothic mansions.
Yeah.
All these elaborate interiors and, like, even, you know, the sort of the costuming. It's not that these people are... It's not a period piece. It's,
no. But it feels period piece-y, even though it's modern. Well,
in the way that, yeah, like, I think it's almost like when people go into an old mansion like that, they become a little period piece-ish.
Yeah. Where do I know Lan Medina from?
He was the first artist on Fables. Who's the colorist on this? Is it Lan Medina? Did he paint it?
I think it was a Villarubia. It's Jose Villarubia.
Because it's got that sort of old-school painted look to it, and it's colors. It reminds me of what Vertigo used to do, but this is not a Vertigo book, right? This is DC.
This is DC.
Because it felt a little more Vertigo. This is what 80s Vertigo felt like to me yeah. in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and it's hard to quite describe the tone. You know, it is gothic, mystery, horror, superhero.
Character-driven, too. Very yeah. character-driven.
It's interesting. Boston Brand is drawn in the very classic Boston Brand way, the sort of weird muscular acrobat with pale
classic
skin.
Neil Adams.
And you know, I kind of thought that they were maybe going to like kind of revamp his look, Tim Burton him up somehow, mm-hmm. but no, they're doing that, and yet the tone, like you say, is more like that kind of weird early Vertigo. It's not quite as adult in the sense of some of the stuff going on. It is more traditionally gothic.
Yeah,
I would say.
Well, it doesn't have the cursing or the nudity or any of that stuff, but it feels mature in story and the way it approaches the story.
Yeah, no, I agree. Anyway, I don't want to say too much else about it. I think it's a fun one, too. It has an enticing mystery
yeah.
and likable characters, and I think that's sort of at the heart of it. I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes because there's interesting tropes in gothic mysteries, and I think there will be both use of them and subversions of it, just based on what I've seen. And I'm looking forward to see what they choose to, where they choose to go. But I'm happy because I also felt that this was the kind of thing that could easily crash and burn.
Yeah.
I thought if it came off as kind of too much of an overt romance thing, it was going to suck. Yeah. And it yeah. didn't.
No, it's really good. Well, Nick, I as always fill in my Marvel whoredom.
Yeah.
Dave went DC. I'm sure that your DC whoredom has taken over. You have a DC book to pick for us.
I do not, actually.
What's your first book?
Instead of talking about gothic horror, I want to talk about liquor. Specifically, Moonshine.
Yeah.
No, this is a new Image book called Moonshine. It's helmed by Brian Azzarello, so, you know.
And his old partner in crime.
Eduardo Rizzo. So the creative team of 100 Bullets.
That's a DC that's a Vertigo book. This is the DC pick.
It's a stealth DC pick by way of Image.
Actually, this does feel like the kind of thing that they probably would have done it at Vertigo.
Yeah, but I mean, Image is sort of the new home for yeah. it. But this tells kind of an interesting story about it takes place during Prohibition, so everybody's scrambling to sort of find the best liquor they can.
But it's not in New York City or Chicago.
No, it is not in New York City or Chicago.
Those are the only places that existed in Prohibition era.
True.
This takes place in Spine Ridge, West Virginia.
Yep.
Okay.
And basically it's about a mobster who is... He's kind of on the outs with his crime boss.
Joe Mazzaria, the yeah. real crime boss, yes, which is. I loved.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
And he basically gets tasked to go to West Virginia to find the source of this best liquor.
Yeah.
And
there's this moonshine that Mazzaria says is the best moonshine he's had.
Yeah. And this guy is not the greatest guy. He's a drunk. And
yeah.
he kind of moseying into Virginia thinking that he's going to find this and it's all going to be easy. And it's not going to be easy.
He just figures he's going to find a bunch of hicks.
He's just going to steamroll them.
I actually loved the Masseria. Yeah. He's all like, get an make an appointment with this guy, and it's like,
yeah.
You guys don't know West Virginia. You don't know the, and it felt kind of this sort of justified like type of story that's being told.
Yeah.
And Eduardo Risso's artwork is so beautiful. Yeah. It captures kind of the look and feel and kind of the griminess of it. And the sort of the dapperness that he has, that our main character has in his full-on suit and fedora, and sort of him trying to sort of make nice at the local diner, wanting some pasta, and it's like, that's not something that exists in West Virginia.
It's a fish out of water story in some ways, yeah.
And of course there is a big twist, and I don't want to give it away.
You know what's weird? The big twist is not really shown here.
It's not. It's hinted at, especially in the opening.
They hint at it in the opening, but
you all know about it from advance.
Yes.
Word and stuff like that.
And anybody who can look at the cover and
moonshine
can probably guess.
If we tell you it's supernatural, you'll probably figure it out.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just thought it was a really well done story.
Yeah, it's a good opener.
It's probably one of the strongest openers that Azzarello has done for me personally in a long time.
But I also feel like people who liked 100 Bullets are going to love this.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of the same intricacies and sense of place.
I think anybody who likes crime, I mean, will find a sort of a part of this. Anybody who's reading that Brian Hurt
The Damned
is kind of like that.
If you liked Boardwalk Empire, this feels like a mix of Boardwalk Empire and Justified.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a good read.
I also love basically the one who's making the moonshine, the character. He's kind of this older, kind of, you kind of pin him as being a redneck in a lot of ways, but he is smart.
They give him
and
that
sly.
Sophistication.
He's sort of like in Justified Season 2, the woman.
Boy. Oh, yeah.
Kind of that kind of edge
Mags.
To her. Mags. It's got that kind of edge to this guy. So
yeah, agreed.
I was very impressed with it.
Yep. Well, Nick, I know your backup pick's got to be a DC comic.
Yes, it is a DC comic. Haha, you are correct. And that's Shade the Changing Girl, the first issue of that, which is...
the second Young Animal book.
Gerard Way's sort of new line at DC, but this is not...
Previously
this is,
had been Doom Patrol. It had Doom Patrol out, and this is the next new one.
And he's showrunning all of these books, but this is written by Cecil Castellucci, who did the Plain Janes.
Yeah, she's written a lot of young adult fiction, and she did Plain Janes for the Minx line, which was one of the previous DC books.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, the Minx line was just ahead of its time. If the Minx line came out today with the audience we have, I think it would have done fantastic.
It was a great idea done at the wrong time.
I wonder if they still have the rights. They should put all those back out in print.
Oh, I would. And then the art is by Marley Zarcone, which I'm not familiar with.
I don't know either, but her work is beautiful.
It feels very much in line with sort of the people who are on, like, Doctor Strange, The Oath, like Marcus Martin, and
Javier
Pulido.
It reminds me of Chris Piccolo's work on Shade, when he was a little more restrained.
Yeah, but... sort of the basics. I'm not a huge, you know, knowledgeable about Shade the Changing Man and all the other... But this is about sort of an alien that takes up residence in a human's body. Sort of this young teenage girl, and because she's heard such great things about Earth, and sort of wants to experience those things firsthand, and she steals... In her alien world, she steals the jacket, the...
M-Vest.
It's a weird, that M-Vest thing goes back to, like, this old Steve Ditko.
Yeah, the original thing, Shade, which they come from the dimension of madness, and they can sort of travel through this dimension to ours, and she sort of sees things differently, and...
Yeah, and it's, I mean, the vest is, and sort of her, as, like, producing this madness all around her, and, like...
Does it still, like the old Shade thing way back in the day created this almost like external like hologram of you yourself around you?
That's not in this.
Yeah, that's not in this.
I just wondered if that was even part of it at all.
She just sort of warps reality, I think.
Yeah, she warps reality and sort of has to deal with kind of the modern life of a teenager, and especially the teenager that she was... sort of takes up residence in, who is in a coma, and she is not the nicest person in the world, apparently, because her parents aren't super...
She was a mean girl.
And sort of having to come to grips with that. I don't know, there were some interesting questions and interesting ideas that portrayed in this first issue, and I just thought the art was so gorgeous and kind of presented that madness in a very beautiful way. So I liked it quite a bit. Maybe not as much as Doom Patrol, but I definitely thought it was good.
Cool. Dave, your backup pick?
So backup pick for me is from Black Mask Studios, the comic Black, number one.
Not Mask.
Not Mask.
Black Mask Black. Presents Black.
You know what this is about? Black.
Yes.
So it really is. And it has a premise that sounded to me like it was... I was honestly, when I remember reading about this, I was both intrigued and worried that it was going to be like too on the nose.
Yeah.
Because the very quick pitch, which it ends up being more interesting than this to me, was sort of a world where the only people who had superpowers were black people.
Yes.
And that does propose a very interesting power dynamic, just off the top of your head. But it's not one... The vibe I got as I was reading this was that like, powers don't seem very well known in it.
Right.
If it's at all... Like, it feels more like... what were we just talking about? That sort of Matrix level.
It's got a Matrix-y... So, this opens with three teenagers being gunned down by a cop.
Right. This is going to a situation that is going to feel very ripped from the headlines.
Yes.
Yeah. And difficult.
No particular headlines, because it happens pretty much every week.
Right. Yesterday's headlines, 5 years ago's headlines.
Yeah, hopefully not tomorrow's headlines.
2 weeks ago's headlines, yes.
At any rate, three black teenagers are gunned down, and then one of them gets back up.
Yeah, it's like at the morgue, he just kind of springs back.
Yeah.
Not unlike what you might see of, say, Wolverine
yeah.
or something like that. And a sort of dramatic chase ensues.
It's not in the morgue. It's actually in an ambulance.
Yeah, it's in the ambulance.
That's right. That's right. I saw the little EKG thing.
And he's being chased by the cops, but he's also being chased by what looks like this shadowy government agency.
Yep.
And then he's rescued by a mysterious figure. And it feels like something out of the Matrix.
Right. Rescued by Morpheus.
This is a Morpheus-esque guy, but it also reminded me of, in some ways, more classic superhero tropes, where you run into that mentor-type figure who's, like, clearly a badass, too.
Yeah.
There does indeed, he's backed up by this team of very cool looking, superpowered types.
Yeah.
That's the most, suddenly, like, that's the first superhero-y thing you see in it.
Yeah.
It has that look that reminds me a little bit of Valiant, superheroes, which is to say, not capes and masks per se, but a little bit more techno, even... This isn't quite right, but what's the game that you're playing all the time now?
Overwatch.
A little Overwatchy.
Yeah, Overwatch is sort of anime influenced.
I guess so. I guess what I just mean is it does not look like traditional Western superheroes.
No, it doesn't.
There's armored swordsman type. This chick in the hood and all that stuff. And the kid ends up in secret base not quite a traditional secret base. But begins finding out a little bit about what's going on, and that's where some of the fun is. And I don't want to say too much about what happens afterwards. What struck me is that this comic almost could have come from Valiant, in the sense of it had that kind of clean storytelling that Valiant is known for, and in some ways almost a little bit of a Bronze Age superhero vibe. Like an 80s era comic, where they're like rethinking tropes for sure, but it's also not wildly political.
No, it's not. I mean,
as the concept almost demands it be, it's more Matrix suspense in this first issue.
Now, Dave, you haven't read a lot of Milestone comics, right?
No.
This felt to me like some of the best Milestone comics.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. That's I've read enough Milestone that I can see what you're saying there. As the issue goes on, you'll kind of start to find out a little bit more about the what's going on, where the powers come from, what the conspiracy is or might be, and meet some supporting characters and some threats. Anyway, I thought it was a bang up first issue.
This is black and white art, right?
It is.
It's sort of gray toned.
Yeah,
it's gray toned.
By Tim Smith III, who I know from. Way back when, did a werewolf private eye book that I still have on my shelf.
Okay.
Written by Kwanza Osage-Yifo.
Doesn't Jamal Igle do the artwork?
Jamal Igle is one of the... Oh, he's the illustrator.
Yeah, he's the
Tim Smith 3 did the designs. Okay, yeah. Igle's done a ton of stuff, and this looks really good.
Yeah, this is phenomenal.
I didn't realize it was him, but that makes sense. I did sort of... There was a part of me that kind of wished this had been in color.
Yeah.
But it is so well drawn, though, that... It's a fairly minor complaint.
I really like this book. Had you not picked it, it would have been one of my picks. You know what it reminds me of also? Mm-hmm. Alters, that book that we liked.
Yeah. And then I'm actually really looking forward to Alters. These superhero universes are the ones that are kind of most interesting to me at the moment.
And that's what I was going to say. What they have in common is they both take off from sort of a social justice vantage point, whether it's making representation for a trans character or examining a world in which what would happen if all the superheroes were black. But that's not their point of view. Their point of view is here's a different superhero universe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The fears in both cases that this was going to be, and like, it sounds weird to say, a social justice comic.
Look, I don't want to call him out, but we worried it might go into Jeb Winnick territory. Where yeah. Jeb Winnick's a super liberal who I agree with more often than not, but every so often you read like, his books up, and you're Jeb. Like, oh my God, shut up.
We get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not that. It's definitely just good, solid superheroes.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to see, you know, what its voice will be, you know, what the undertones will be and themes it'll continue to explore. But yeah, at its basics, this is a, you know, badass new superhero story.
All right. My final pick is Jessica Jones number one.
Uh-huh.
It comes with a big giant caveat, which is all three of us, when we read this book in order of spoilers,
yeah.
They're like, there's like, yeah, there's something weird about it. And the other person would be like, well, what's weird? And like, I can't tell you because it'll spoil the premise.
Yeah.
So I will agree. I haven't been the last person to read it. There's something weird about it, but I can't tell the readers what it is weird about it without spoiling the premise.
They've made a few unusual choices as to directions and things like that.
It's not even a few. It's one notable one.
Right.
And I think the thing is, in order to do a Jessica Jones ongoing book, the place where she's at right now, she's a happily married mom, and she's retired from the superhero game. And she's retired from the private eye game. So there's not a book there.
Right.
So they were going to have to change something. And what they change is something that I think a lot of people liked. I know I did. And in order to get her back to the sort of somewhat damaged, isolated place that she was when she was in Alias, which this book is very much...
And what most people will know from the TV show Jessica Jones.
The Alias was written by Brian Bendis, set up by Michael Gatos, which is the creative team here, to get her back to this, which basically feels like picking up Alias... from where it was canceled because now the sales justify it.
Right.
In order to get to that place, they had to make a pretty big change to the character. And I don't like that change, and I'm really nervous about it. And at the same time, I recognize that there was really no better option.
What if the change had just been, I think I'm going to start drinking again.
Yeah. It's not that.
But beyond that change...
Beyond that change...
There is a reason somehow it has made its way into your picks.
Beyond that change... It's really well done. If you read Alias, you know that Alias was really fun. Alias early on did some stuff where it was like, had her on the toilet, it had her having sex with Luke Cage, had her using the F-bomb every other word. Like, it was very mature. Like, they were trying to prove how not for kids they were.
Yeah.
And they don't have to prove that here. Like, it is definitely still not for kids. It's aimed at a mature audience.
It even says that on the cover.
Yes, it does. But this is not, look how grown up Marvel can be.
Right.
This is actually Jessica Jones distilled into sort of what she is at her best, which is a look at dealing with personal damage, dealing with sort of small cases in the strange world of the Marvel Universe.
A little bit of the procedurals, the interviewee or interrogation stuff that Bendis likes.
Yes, the case she gets here deals with the kind of thing that would be hard to do in a non-superhero universe. I don't want to say specifics, but the previous issue had her, or the previous volumes had her dealing with secret identity troubles for Captain America, or...
an outcast kid who's...
Rick Jones.
Yeah, someone who's trying to be Rick Jones, the famous superhero sidekick.
Yeah, and there was like an outcast kid who they thought had committed suicide and might have been a mutant, right. It was Marvel Universe cases.
And that is brought back here, which I think is one of the things that the Jessica Jones TV show missed for me was it didn't have any of those cases. It was all so focused on the Purple Man. The Purple Man does not make an appearance in Jessica Jones number one, and I'm very glad of that.
This is
just more of getting back to Jessica Jones being Jessica Private PI, and there's guest starring turns from Jessica Drew and from Misty Knight, both of whom feel just a little bit off. I think the problem I have here is that since Bendis created her, Jessica Jones has been done really well by other people like David Walker over in Power Man and Iron Fist.
Yeah.
Misty Knight is being done very well by Nick Spencer. Jessica Drew is being done very well by Dennis Hopeless. And Bendis does not seem to be paying any heed to any of that. This is definitely Bendis taking the characters and using them the way he wants to use them, which annoys me. And yet, it's really good. If you liked Alias or if you like Jessica Jones.
As the creator of Jessica Jones... I do have to give him some leeway in figuring out the character.
I also want to point out, I think this is great stuff by Gatos.
Oh yeah, it's
and
really
I want to say it might even be a little bit stronger than his original run.
They honestly always worked well together. He knows how to do Bendis's conversational beats and break up a conversation,
yep,
and all that stuff. So they work well together.
Yep,
they got that synergy thing.
All right. Also on my list this week, and there's a lot of Marvel Now restarts this week, which is what we have at number one for Jessica Jones and Champions.
Yeah. And we should say Marvel Now is not like a mega reboot, just kind of new directions and stories and stuff.
Well, that's what they do when they do, Marvel Now is basically when they relaunch after an event. So there'll be new number ones, but also they're keeping the original numbering on most of their books, but they do have new number ones up in the right corner that indicate this is essentially a jumping on point for the book.
Yeah.
And so Doctor Strange number 12. Is the start of Blood in the Aether, which pits Doctor Strange up against three big foes in one issue, and also introduces the new sort of lower magic Doctor Strange that is a result of the empirical story they just finished. Really, really good stuff. Enchanted Tiki Room number one, which is another fun one from Disney. I really liked this.
That's from their ride series, so they did, yeah, Haunted Mansion and all that, and now at last, because someone demanded it, the Enchanted Tiki
Room. Hey, I like the Enchanted Tiki Room, and I like what they do with it. Midnight Apollo number one. Archie Meets the Ramones, number one. The next part of Amazing Spider-Man's Dead No More story, and Amazing Spider-Man number 19, which continues to be just really good. The start of All New Wolverine's Enemy of the State 2, which is a really good opener. Angel City from Oni, which is a female-fronted classic noir book. Voltron Legendary Defender number 3, which is more of the Voltron animated series, a new story set in that universe. The Great Divide number 2, which I talked about last time, is a very strange new post-apocalypse story. And Ever After number 2, which is the sort of espionage in the world of fables that I really like the first issue of. There's also a couple graphic novels. There's the anthology from Dark Horse, The Secret Loves of Geek Girls, which is a nonfiction anthology mixing prose, comics, and illustrated stories about the lives and loves of an amazing cast of female creators. Includes Margaret Atwood, Mariko Tamaki, Marguerite Bennett, Marjorie Liu, Carl Speed McNeil, a number of different creators, 50 more creators in this, sort of all these women who work in comics and fiction telling stories of their own romantic journeys. Squirrel Girl Beats Up the Marvel Universe, an original graphic novel by the creators of the Squirrel Girl comic, and the final volume of Hawkeye, Volume 3, by Jeff Lemire and Ramon Perez, which focused a lot on Kate and I really liked.
It was a beautiful cover.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
Like, really pop.
All the covers on that book were really good. Dave, what else is on your list?
Let's see. I'm going to, because it's on top, start with a graphic novel thing. We got both volumes of Oni Press's, it's Oni, right?
But it's their site, Nimrod's Press.
It's their new line of sex-positive comics. It's going to be, is it going to be include, like, porn stuff?
I don't know. It's for grown-ups. It's all me.
Yeah, it's for sure. This one is the online webcomic, Ojoy Sex Toy. Which is a and this basically compiles both in two volumes. It was a little weird that they released.
There's three volumes, actually.
Okay,
the third volume has not come out yet.
Okay, but it's a little weird that they released two at the same time.
That's because it's been released in the sort of not the book market but the convention circuit.
Okay,
and Oni is publishing it to the wider audience of the comic shops,
gotcha,
and bookshops,
gotcha,
and that kind of thing.
Anyway, this is indeed an adults only kind of look at it's a husband and wife who kind of, you know, talking to the reader through their comics. Literally review sex toys.
Well, they are sent sex toys by a variety of publishers. There's also, they go to a strip club, they talk about porn, they talk about swingers clubs, everything sort of sex friendly.
Right, but also like serious stuff, I think like STDs and stuff there. So it's like hyper informative, but kind of charmingly done.
It's cute, really cute cartooning. Mm-hmm. It's very explicit.
Yes.
But it's very funny and sort of goofy and... They're really entertaining, and it's a book that I've read all three volumes of, and it's really it's a webcomic that I've really liked.
Let's see, what else do I have here? Got the fourth issue of Flintstones, which, Randy, as you noted, I haven't read it yet, but the cover seems to be running with the notion that Neanderthals were polygamous.
Yes.
Their big controversy is that monogamy is destroying things.
Fred and Wilma are getting married, and it's as if gay marriage is destroying society.
Yeah, there's protesters. also from the Hanna-Barbera line, I've got Future Quest number 5. Let's see. Randy, did you mention Big Trouble in Little China meets... is it just called Big Trouble in Little China? Escape from New York?
Yes.
Not meets?
Nope.
Yes, it's double the Kurt Russell power.
Yep.
I want to point out, before we go any further, in a smaller week, this probably might have made one of my picks.
It could have been a pick. It's Greg,
I really wanted to read it, and I only read a few pages.
It's Greg Pak writing. It's got a great premise. And I've not been a fan of either The Big Trouble in Little China or Escape from New York Comics from Boom. But this was really fun. It's dumb. It is so dumb, but it's dumb in the same way
that...
But it
seemed like a creatively inspired way to get basically Jack Burton and Snake Plissken somehow in the same place at the same time.
It's dumb in the same way Escape from New York and Big Trouble in Little China are dumb, which is a fun dumb.
Yeah, it's fun. It's not super dumb.
Let's see. There's a crime comic from Titan Comics called Trigger Man. That's from
The Killer.
It's from the writer of the European graphic novel The Killer, or graphic novel series that was about that hitman.
Matt's,
yep. And but based on a story by Walter Hill, who you may know as the Macho Man, is it writer or director of movies like The Warriors?
I think he's the director.
And he's produced, you know, like I feel like he produced Lethal Weapon and Predator and like a bunch of other real testosterone fueled films. And this is a Prohibition-era crime story with some really nice European-style artwork. I don't know that I can yet say that it brings a ton new to the table, but it's an interesting, kind of an intriguing series. There's a hyper pulp cartoony series from Marvel called Cage.
Like Genndy Tartakovsky.
Genndy Tartakovsky, you know, Samurai Jack, Powerpuff Girls. It's his homage to basically the Luke Cage of the 70s and also the comics he loved of the 70s, including a crazy scene that homages the, was it Spalding basketball?
Yes, the Spalding basketball ads with Dr. J
and
I don't remember who the other guy was, to be honest.
Yeah, I can't quite remember, but... But yeah, like literally Luke Cage is in that role. We were trying to decide if this comic was racist.
We all like this comic, but we're not sure it might be racist.
It is a hyper-exaggerated, almost Mad Magazine style, you know, like Jack Davis cartooning of like the blaxploitation era.
Yeah.
And there's exaggerated characters and features, but it's sort of for everybody.
It's really fun. I'm just not sure it's okay.
Luke Cage, you know, is definitely the kind of guy who'd be like, step off, fool, you know, but... It is a lot of goofy fun. I think most people are going to enjoy it. I'll be curious to see what reactions are. Some people might be like, this is a little racist. It's beautifully cartooned. It's not serious.
No,
it's
not at all.
It's more like if you've ever seen Kyle Baker's like Plastic Man series that DC was doing in the 2000s, which had, you know, just a little bit of seriousness to it, but was very larger than life.
Yeah.
And comedic. That's what Cage is doing. But if you're missing Luke Cage with Afro, chain belt, and gold shirt, then Cage is the series for you. Warren Ellis has a new comic from Aftershock Comics called Shipwreck, which is a kind of mind-bendy mystery story that seems to have like sci-fi and mystical elements in it. Has really nice art from Phil Hester, who you know, did the Kevin Smith Green Arrow run back in the day. And I think that covers most of the stuff I've read or was right on the cusp of reading when we jumped into podcast. Nick,
what else you got?
I have a few more. So I've got the start or the number one issue of the big crossover Death of X.
It's going to finally reveal what Cyclops did that made everybody so mad.
It's the first appearance of the Terrigen Mists as they come across and sort of first come in contact with mutants. So. If that has been bugging you as to what happened to Cyclops, this is where you're going to find your answers.
Charles Soule, notably writing.
Jeff Lemire.
And Jeff Lemire, so they got some of their big guns.
Art by Aaron Cooter, who had that really good run on Action Comics.
Yep. And he has a sort of Frank Quitely look, so it looks a little bit like New X-Men back when Grant Morrison was doing
it. True. The miniseries from DC, Death of Hawkman, starts. So right there in the title, it's a kind of dark. But no, I actually really like this. It's written by Mark Andreyko, beautiful art by Aaron Lopresti.
And Hawkman's barely in it.
It's
so weird. It's like,
really?
It's an Adam Strange book.
It's mainly an Adam Strange book. Sort of his life going back and forth between Ran and Earth. And sort of the parallels of the lives he leads in both.
I'm guessing there'll be more Hawkman later. And then
I would imagine
after his death, surprisingly less.
Yeah.
Night of the Monster Men continues this week in Batman and Nightwing, which are both really good. The eighth issue of Superman, which starts the new story arc, Escape from Dinosaur Island, because, you know, that's all.
Sure.
The new miniseries He-Man and Thundercats starts up.
Which He-Man fights Thundercats.
I'm going to guess if you need a direct EpiPen-style dose of 80s cartoon style, this comic should do it for you.
The 8th issue of Green Arrow, which is Green Arrow and Black Canary.
That art is so nice.
It's beautiful.
And I haven't read a few issues. I'm a few issues behind now, but I think I'm going to read this issue randomly because it looks so cool.
And then Green Valley number 1, which is Max Landis and Giuseppe Camuncoli's new sort of fantasy book, which it's beautiful. It's an interesting start. We'll see where it goes.
All right. That wraps up our comics talk for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and video games. So I don't know about you guys, but I had a busy weekend.
Yeah.
Because not only did Luke Cage drop on Friday, Westworld came out on Sunday, and XCOM 2, which I've been waiting for forever, came out on PS4, and I got that on Friday. So if you were to say Luke Cage, Westworld, and XCOM 2, that is 90% of what I did this weekend. The other 10% is working on my podcast, Beach Cop Detectives.
You might say you're immersed in pop culture.
I am very much immersed in pop culture. Westworld, I'm going to cheat and say I'm going to talk a lot about that on my podcast, TV Dudes, this week. So if you want to know what I thought, if you care, check out TV Dudes when it comes out on Friday.
Are you going to hint whether you liked it or not?
I loved it.
Okay.
But let's talk about Luke Cage, which...
Okay.
How much have you watched, Nick?
I have watched, I believe, 7 episodes, but possibly 8. I can't remember where I left off.
I think you and I are in the exact same place. And Dave, you have watched less than
that. I've watched an episode.
Yep. So we'll try to keep it somewhat spoiler-free. But what do you guys think?
Best Netflix show.
Nick says
what?
Best Netflix Marvel show.
Wow. It's actually my least favorite.
And I liked the first episode but didn't love it, and I'm going to catch some more episodes.
So in our binary system, he's in the middle.
Yep. And I'm
by the way, we are continually misusing the word binary because...
It's not binary.
There can't be a middle in a binary system.
There is a binary system where you either love or hate something. You are not in the binary system.
We're in the trinary
system. We have another system beyond the binary system, which is one of us loves something, one of us hates it, and the other one's in the middle.
Yep.
And so on this roll, I am the guy who hates it, even though I quite liked it. But the thing I realized is that about all the Netflix shows as I watch this is that
people are always talking about they're stretched.
They're all stretched. I mean, it definitely feels a little long at 13 episodes. But also, I realized that what Netflix does, they're doing sort of cable TV style superheroics. So it's all
sort of like Breaking Bad influence.
Very, very, very intelligent, very literary. Like there's a long discussion. You haven't seen this yet, Dave, but there's a discussion between Pops and Luke Cage in the barbershop where they're talking about
crime novelists,
and they bring up like Walter Mosley, and they talk about Donald Goines and Westlake, and they basically are talking about all these writers, and it's a very intelligent conversation. It's the kind of thing you'd never see in the comics.
It's true.
And the approach here is definitely to do very character driven, very sort of low level superheroes. Like Luke Cage is bulletproof, but there's not going to be another bulletproof guy that he throws down with. You know,
right.
It's like. And that's why I think I realized that ultimately, while I like Daredevil, my favorite thing about Daredevil is the Kingpin. Because the Kingpin works on that level as a crime boss and exploring sort of what that means. And why Jessica Jones is my favorite of the Netflix series, because Jessica Jones is conversational and dirty and noir and all the things that Netflix does well. Luke Cage, honestly, what I want out of Luke Cage is either what McDuffie did back in the 80s or what Walker's doing now. I want him a little larger than life.
Right.
And this is much more grounded.
It's grounded. I just enjoy just kind of the... I like the slow burn of it.
Yeah.
I do like the elongated... Because I don't feel like it's, like, weirdly paced or anything. There's definitely doing story arcs and, you know, all the characters are getting their arcs and...
But it's sort of one big story, and I don't know that works for 13 episodes.
See, I feel like there's little stories interspersed throughout. There is a bigger one.
Yeah.
But where Jessica Jones just had Purple Man, and that's all she had.
Yeah.
This one feels like, okay, you have Cottonmouth, you've got Black Mariah, you've got... you know, another villain that I'm not going to mention.
Well, he's mentioned in the first episode, Diamondback. But people won't know who that is if you haven't read the comics.
You've got a bunch of other connective tissue to the other Netflix shows.
Sure.
And I think they're really interestingly placed and used.
Oh, there's so much they do well. Like, Mike Colton is perfect as Luke Cage. He's really
Coulter,
great.
Isn't that Mike Colter?
Is it Mike Colter? Mike Colter, yes. He's got that physical presence.
Yeah.
But he also brings in Luke's sort of gravitas and sort of swagger, and yet also this sort of, you know, wounded animal hiding from the world a little bit.
This is, in a lot of ways, this is Luke Cage year one.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to be a hero. He doesn't view himself in that way. And this is sort of his path to that place.
And I can never pronounce the actor's name, but the guy playing Cottonmouth is fantastic.
His laugh and his sort of sinister being.
I think that's the thing, is that one of the things I've really liked about the Netflix series was Vincent D'Onofrio giving Kingpin a third dimension.
Yeah.
And that's definitely done here. Like, the villain is believable and relatable, and he's the hero of his own story.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. And Alfred Woodard kills this Mariah.
Yeah, she's great.
And also, let's talk about the music, which is fantastic throughout.
I mean, one of the big kind of places in Luke Cage is Cottonmouth's club.
Yeah.
And he gets to have a lot of acts on stage.
I saw just in the first episode, there was the guy who does this sort of neo-soul, I'm going to blank on his name, though, Raphael Sadiq,
I think. Yeah, I believe that's right.
Who was, like, I think had, like, some kind of pop hits in, like, that Boys to Men era 90s. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was with them, but he was kind of one of those kind of, I would say, slightly schlocky bands. And then reinvented himself in the 2000s doing kind of neo-soul that's really cool and has that, you know, like, kind of Motown 60s, 70s sound to it. And he's really good. So other acts recur throughout?
There's, like, a James Brown, which I think Randy pointed out to me before I'd seen it, and I was like, no, he's dead on this.
It feels like the resurrected James Brown do a live performance.
And it's great. But, you know, that combined with just sort of Netflix general cinematography.
Yeah, they give you a real sense of Harlem.
And it feels, I mean, yeah, we got Hell's Kitchen with Daredevil. Yep.
And of course, we know that these are not necessarily, Hell's Kitchen we know now is like all gentrified and yuppied up and stuff like that. And I gather Harlem to some degree
still
is
still kind of Harlem. I mean, this feels like modern day Harlem.
Yeah, I mean, the mob still runs. I mean, they collect taxes.
I just assumed it was still, in its own way, sort of a stylized version of it.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely 70s influenced Harlem.
Right.
Yeah. But it's this show is really, really well done. The character stuff, I mean, when he interacts with Pops, the show's never better.
Right.
And I like what they do with Misty Knight. I like what they do with Raphael Scharf. However, I miss the badass cartoonish Misty Knight that's in Captain America.
Yeah.
And that character would feel out of place in the show.
Or the kind of little bit more bravado to him, Luke Cage, of the comics.
Yeah. But I think I can see the evolution of them getting to that character.
Maybe. I don't see any sense that they're going to give Misty a bionic arm.
I could see them doing it.
Maybe. We'll
see. Because once you get to the point where you have an indestructible man, you're going to have a guy using his chi to power his fist.
Yeah.
A blind man. I mean, they're definitely laying... It's subtle ground.
That's an element of faith that I don't feel like extending at this point. It's like,
faith in their writing skills, but that not that they're going to fulfill what you want.
Exactly. When they get to that, if they get to that point and Defenders has like full on superhero action, I will say, oh, I was wrong. I don't expect to be saying I was wrong.
You think it's going to stay street level?
The Netflix shows do a certain thing and they do it very well. And it's very well done. And don't get me wrong, I'm going to watch all Luke Cage. I'm going to be excited to watch Iron Fist. I'm excited to watch The Defenders. But I realized in watching Luke Cage that it's not exactly what I want it to be.
I'm just wondering what do you do that street level that you can gather all these heroes together and sort of put them against a big element, if that's what they're doing?
I don't know.
I mean,
it's got to be some sort of mystery or threat that for like
because
the whole
city.
Because
it can't just be another like crime boss.
No, I would imagine it would be like, I mean, did they do The Hand yet?
Yeah,
they did The Hand in season 2 of Daredevil.
Did they have a mystical element in it?
Yes. Somewhat, yeah.
Okay.
Well, they're literally bringing people back from the dead.
Yeah.
I feel like you could tie that in, if not directly to The Hand, but then to some other Marvel agencies, whether it's like AIM or something like that. Have they done stuff with AIM before?
No, well, only in Iron Man 3.
Oh yeah, it was 3.
But you could essentially have sinister organizations with designs on, say, New York that bring them together.
Yeah,
it would have to be something that you couldn't track through normal legal means, and yet below the Avengers threat level, which makes sense for their power levels.
Yeah.
I think they will come up with some sort of kind of rather large conspiracy that they have to deal with.
We'll see. I really like Luke Cage. But I did sort of realize in watching it that it's not 100% what I want them to do with. My lane for superheroes is CW TV and Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this feels more like what DC's trying to do with its movies, if that were done well.
Right.
Wow, I don't... Okay.
That makes sense.
I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm the only one here who's played XCOM 2.
Correct.
Dave goes back to XCOM, like the original.
The original XCOM, like the PC version. I played it on the PlayStation 1, which it was not an easy port to.
Yeah.
It had long load times, had a weird arcane control scheme. I remember, like, accidentally, like, saving over a game when I was, like, 20 hours into it or something, and it was painful.
And then we all played XCOM Enemy Unknown on PS2. PS3. PS3.
Yeah.
Or Xbox 360.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And
great update.
Yeah, a fantastic update where it was basically still squad-based, but the graphics were better.
Finally turn-based.
Yeah, turn-based, yeah.
Still infuriating.
And very, very hard.
You know, it was Tunic, but for me, the challenge level was right about where I want it to be.
Yeah.
I know you were playing it on that, you played it on that crazy level where you can't reload old games.
It's true.
That's insane.
I would never do that, especially on a first playthrough.
I played that for fun on my third playthrough and got frustrated very quickly.
Yeah,
because the wrong move, it's very easy when your guy gets mind control to target him by accident and kill them.
Yeah,
and you're like, there's no going back now. I accidentally killed that dude.
And more fun when I could keep in my you know, giving names to my characters, letting them get really badass. And if I lost them, I would kind of weigh, is it worth replaying it? Sometimes I would do it just because I was like, man, the missions are always super fun, so I would do it just... Well,
XCOM is like that DM you have who's like, hey, dead means dead.
Yeah.
Because there's no, like, if you target one of your guys' mind control, it doesn't say, are you sure you want to shoot your own guy?
Yeah.
Are you sure you don't want to shoot the mind-controlling alien? And I'm like, actually, I wanted to shoot the mind-controlling alien. I didn't realize I was targeting my own guy, but you didn't warn me.
Yeah,
piece of crap computer. I may have said exactly that with much more cursing. But XCOM is, at its base, the story of a multi-governmental organization, a military organization that is dealing with an alien invasion. And XCOM 2
takes us into combat, and then there's also sort of a sim thing where you're building up your organization.
You build your base, you build the technology to deal with, you steal tech from the aliens and use it to incorporate into your gear, and your soldiers get better with more experience.
Yeah.
So there's almost a role-play element to it.
Yeah.
And XCOM 2 has all of that. You have a base. I don't want to give away the base because it's really cool. But you have a base. You're working with the resistance, though, because in this world, the aliens successfully took over in sort of a V-style thing where they are called the Advent, and they have mixed human and alien DNA, and they are sort of presenting themselves as the friend. It's kind of like the Reach in Young Justice.
Yeah.
They're presenting themselves as friends, although they are definitely really not. And XCOM is sort of underfunded and underground and trying to reveal the truth and take these guys out before they successfully initiate what they call the Avatar Project, which is something that's going to give them full control over the Earth. So you are really under the gun, and you feel really under the gun. Like, every time I do something, I'm wondering, am I supposed to be feeling like I really screwed up, or is this just the game trying to make me feel the pressure of it?
Right.
Because
You'll have, like, cutscenes where the guys are like, you're behind, you know, we're going to lose this war,
yeah,
and stuff, right?
So you've got to balance your resources, you've got to choose when to go pick up more scientists, more engineers, you got to train your soldiers, give them better gear, and then the aliens will retaliate against you for raids, or you've got these horrible missions where you've got to go rescue civilians before they murder them all.
Yeah.
And you've got to be
still what they call that in the original one, and maybe in the remake, terror sites.
No, they call them retaliation missions now.
Oh, interesting.
So retaliation strikes.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give too much away about all of it because Dave's going to play it, and I don't want to spoil the story. But it's very much in classic XCOM mode, and yet at the same time, it adds some new twists. I like that you can know, even if you played all the XCOM before, you can know sort of what you're doing, but you don't know what you're supposed to be doing when, and so it still has that sort of mystery and that frustrating and yet really engaging, someone you've really built up gets killed, or you go on the wrong mission, or you have to pull out of a mission so you don't all die, and you have to make tough choices about who to save and who not to save, and it's
and
really,
from,
really entertaining.
Aside from all the cool tactical decisions, like just the moment-to-moment turn-based combat is super fun, looks great, from what if it's anything like the previous one.
Yeah.
But usually they have a kind of cool story unfolding, too.
Yeah, they do. This is a very addictive game. When I got it, I played it for like 8 hours straight. And gotten to a place where last few times, and they also think one thing they do here is that, and I feel like this is a change in XCOM 2, It auto-saves, basically, when you're in combat, it auto-saves every turn, and it keeps those last three turns. So if things get out of hand, you can always go back up to three turns.
Okay.
But no further.
Right.
So
that's a good balance.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting.
And I'm sure that's on regular mode. I'm sure playing in veteran or Iron Man, there's no such safeguards or net. But I love this game. I'm definitely going to play. There's also a multiplayer component. I haven't explored it all yet, but it's interesting to have a multiplayer component. So definitely recommended. All right. That is it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
Yo-jo!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.